Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Right to the Source. My name is Robin Harrison, and I am here, as ever, with Ed Birkin. I've watched you frantically prepare for this in the past few minutes before we hit record. Ed, how the devil are you?
Hi, Robin. I'm good, thanks.
Excellent.
As you say, we're trying to change the format a bit, make it a bit shorter, and potentially less preparation will mean that we'll talk for a shorter period of time and make it more interesting for people.
That's a great way, I hope. So we'll see how that goes. I think we did quite well in the last episode. I think we kept that under 20 minutes. That felt short. That felt snappy. And let's see how we go on today, because obviously there's quite a lot going on. There's always a lot going on in this industry. But over the past week, there's been a few kind of interesting things come up on IGB and the things that we've been covering, not least a potential sale for Bet365. You know, we've always threatened to bring it back and talk about it because it's always an interesting company. Whenever there's a lack of information, there's a real clamour to find out what's going on. And, well, this week it's potentially got very interesting. Funnily enough, of all the sites to cover it, it's been The Guardian. The Guardian wrote the story, and the story is that senior management at 365 have been speaking to bankers in New York about some possible sales, some possible IPO. We don't really know, as is their wont, they don't comment in these kind of reports, but it's potentially coming at a very interesting time because 365 has been this sort of monolithic company standing kind of atop the industry. And then in recent years, it's obviously expanded into the US. It's got leading positions across multiple European markets. It's divested the Chinese business and it's making a big play for Latin America, specifically Brazil. I think it's also in Mexico. Not sure what it's doing in Peru, if it's even in there. But it's got a lot going on. And, well, yeah, I mean, what do you make of this? Do you feel that an IPO is possible for a company that has been so private for so long?
I mean, if you'd asked me a year ago whether I thought Bet365 was going to do something like this, I'd have said no. I think when you saw in their annual accounts that the football club had been spun out, that could just be for whatever reason, want to keep it separate. Then when you heard they're pulling out of China, it made people question things. And I don't think this therefore come as a big surprise, or at least it makes it believable. My concern with an IPO straight up, or I think it's less likely, and a partial sale was mooted by The Guardian, is that there would be concerns, as me as an ex-analyst, about, you know, it's been run by Denise and John for so long, and, you know, how much are they going to stay around? How important are they? I think to get the maximum value, there needs to be some transition of management. And that's why I think it actually sounds more believable, and either a partial stake or private equity, not this into need the money, but in terms of get them in to get a management transition so that they know this business can, you know, continue to run and be this behemoth in the industry without Denise and John being there, kind of pulling all the strings and relying entirely on them. The other bit I say is, I remember speaking to them, God, this is when I was a junior analyst in banking, and so it was a good 15 plus years ago. Actually, someone there said to me, do you think we should IPO? And I said, for me personally, it would be great because, you know, having you in the sector would be fantastic. I said, but if I were you, I'd be the last thing I'd do because you don't seem to need the money. And why do you want some snotty-nosed little analyst like me, you know, questioning what you do if you slightly miss numbers or growth is down on a quarterly earnings call, when at the moment you can just do what you believe is right for the business longer term and not have to answer to any little shits in the industry, in the banking industry. So, and he laughed and said, yeah, I completely agree. So it's interesting there are, you know, looking down this route, because it is a massive change from, as you say, a private company to being public and then answerable to people is huge. And that's why, you know, they're talking about potential private equity stuff. I think that could be the way to go. But if you are going to IPO, and it makes sense then to do the US market, because one, you get better valuations. Two, I mean, if I were an investor looking at the US market, and we do not give investment advice on this, but if I were doing so, you know, who's got the most potential in the US market? As far as I'm concerned, Bet365. I mean, you know, they've got 2-point-something% market share at the moment in sports betting. Yeah. Could they double that? Yeah. Could they quadruple that? Yeah. I don't think it's unheard of for them to get 10% in the US. And Jewel can't double their market share. They definitely can't quadruple it because that'd be more than 100%. Neither can DraftKings. I don't really see BetMGM doing it. I mean, we can kind of forget about Penn for the moment. So who do you actually see as an operator in the US who is any meaningful size at all who can double, triple their market share?
I think Fanatics is worth bringing them into the conversation. They're a challenger brand, but the other thing, when you look at Fanatics, you've got Matt King, you've got Ari Barod, you've got Brand Tiden, you've got Ted Moss, you've got a bench, you've got a lot of people that you can see, you know, playing leading roles in that company for a long period of time. With 365, it's very much the Coates family. I'm sure there are great people there, but when it comes to leadership, it always goes back to the family.
Yeah, which is why I said I think it'd be difficult for them to I mean, I've been on, you know, I was involved in the Betfair IPO. You know, the management is a big thing and continuity. You know, I don't know them, you know, but, you know, I'd be very surprised if I were running a business like that, you know, and then wanting to, let's say, fully IPO and then have people question, you kind of want to get out, in my view. You're not involved in that.
Of course.
And a lot of them, let's be honest, there's some good analysts out there, but some of the questions that get asked, they'll be being asked questions and feeling they have to answer them about people, and they go, they don't even know what I'm fucking on about. This isn't even a question. Why am I having to try and explain my business to you? So, yeah. And then the other thing about the US is, but let's be honest, I mean, it's not just, so okay, Asia's, China's gone. So if you look at what, at least I estimate the next biggest markets is, so you've got the UK, right? Brazil, Argentina, Canada, Ontario, they're still market leader. You know, for this US companies going in, you know, we're going to go into Canada and do that. No, they're not. At least in sports betting, I'm pretty sure overall they're a market leader. I mean, they've got Spain, you know, doing well, but they've got the US online. So they do have this LATAM area that is a big growth driver and a material part of their business. So why would you list in London? I don't get it. So all of the stuff in the story kind of makes logical sense to me.
Do you feel they need to bring in more talent at that high level? You know, going back to what I was saying about the fact that it always comes back to the family, does Bet3 need a bigger bench rather than, you know, admittedly, the outstanding CEO of online gambling, you know, going back to the early days, you know, the one executive that has been there the entire time that has evolved with the market. Do they need to bring in more talent at that high level, or at least make that talent more visible? Because let's face it, while they're not visible, they have outstanding talent, because just look at the business, you know, across tech, across regulatory affairs, across product, across operations, there have to be a lot of outstanding people there.
Yeah. And obviously, like, you know, I don't think anyone can question, anyone saying can question Denise's talent, but that's, you know, the co-CEOs as well. So obviously, you know, John's done a lot to build that business. But yeah, I mean, whether one or two of them, so without doubt, if I were looking as an analyst, if I were writing a report on the valuation of this pre-IPO, the big red flag would be, how can this business run? Are they going to stay around? Regardless of what they said, are they going to stay around? How can it run without them? Because as you say, there has to be some other exceptional talent in that business. You don't become, you know, biggest brand. Okay, so I've got number three in the UK market share, but in terms of individual brands, number one. It's obviously Entain, Flutter have multiple brands. Brazil, we're number one. I think they can mark number two now. We have the top name. You know, Mexico, I actually have them as number two behind Caliente. Argentina, I think they're at least licensed number one. Ontario, number one. Spain, number one. You know, that's just not two people. But yeah, they'll have to try and, say, showcase that. Or, to be honest, I just don't really see how, I think it'd be difficult for them to maximise the value of this while not having external management in. And external management have also shown they're able to run it, which is why I'd be surprised if they're able to get away with a full IPO as is. And I think a partial thing is more likely.
What about a combination with another brand? I mean, one of the companies that has been cited just by sources that we've talked to when we were covering that story is DraftKings, because DraftKings is very much a US business, resolutely US business. Does a combination with a 365, which essentially internationalizes something of that nature, do you see any scope for that sort of deal? Do you even think that DraftKings is the right company to combine with? I mean, the US gold rush is plateauing. You know, we're on track to have no new states come online in the current legislative session. So does that then mean that they should be looking for a combination with, I mean, someone like a Superbet, a Betano, you know, these real kind of rising stars that are essentially taking, you know, kind of... I suppose where I'm getting with that is these companies that we've seen, the Superbets, the Betanos, they've really kind of following the same approach as the established kind of endemic industry brands. They've grown market share, they've taken the expansion opportunities, and they've executed on them perfectly. They've done really well. They built up this position, this brand recognition, arguably for someone like Betano, culminating when they are all across the Copa America and the Euros. Two biggest football tournaments that happened last year. Soccer for our US listeners, Betano were everywhere. All the pitchside hoardings, they were everywhere. Do you see these companies as potentially a more logical combination?
That was a long question. Came back to the start. I mean, okay, if you talk about, let's work backwards. So Betano, yes, they were everywhere. Superbet, everywhere in Brazil, you know, with the Rio Carnival sponsorship. I think just throwing money at sponsorship doesn't necessarily work or bonuses. You need a decent product. But I think these two have it. I mean, yes. if I'm looking at, you know, the earnings that William Hill, Entain, even Flutter outside of FanDuel were making, you know, 10 years ago when I was in the city, and look at them now. And then you look at Superbet, that was a, you know, one brand. I don't even know if they were even online in Romania back in 10 years ago. Now doing about $1 billion or so of revenue. Kaizen, Betano, doing $3 billion. I mean, like, they really have just completely outstripped operationally everything, all the kind of old guard, so to speak. So I think they are interesting companies and great companies. They clearly have good products. And so if you are a DraftKings, either them or 365, would it be an attractive deal? But US market, we can probably touch on a little bit because I don't think you're allowed. I don't think Megan let you. But I'm off to Miami with some of your IGB colleagues next week for conference. And, you know, the sports isn't... Where do you see the growth coming from in sports? So if you look at Q1... Yes, it's not terrible. GGR is up 13%. Still a couple of stakes to report. March data, handle up 12%. But iGaming's where the growth is. You know, that's up 27% in Q1. March up 26% year on year. Brand new, you know, new record high in every single market that has iGaming. So that's a growth driver, which I know they've got Golden Nugget and they're kind of like pushing in iGaming. You know, on the sports side, do you see loads of growth? I know they've blamed margins, hold margins for stuff, but you know, hold margins aren't going to expand forever. And actually, if you look at what it's done in the last 6-12 months, it's kind of the same as it was the year before. So, you know, you can't just take a good month of hold margin and say this is, you know, margin expansion, underlying margin expansion, and a bad month it's just sports results. You know, 9.5%, is that kind of where they're getting? I mean, I don't see it going massively up, especially if they're going to push in play, which I see as a big driver. And the simple bet acquisition, you know, that's all about micro betting. So DraftKings, well, they're going to try and grow from that micro betting in play. Well, that's lower margin. So, you know, compared to, you know, same game parlays, I know you can get in play parlays, but so I don't think that whole margin bit. So yeah, if you're looking at international businesses, can they then afford it? You know, a Bet365, and I'm not going to comment on the valuation, but because things can move very quickly, but it's about $9 billion. Is it $9 billion sterling, $12 billion, something like that?
I think it was $9 billion we were talking about.
You know, how do DraftKings do that? Because if I'm in the Coates family, I'm not accepting DraftKings equity. Like, look what happened when they tried to do it with, you know, Ladbrokes and then Entain and whatever. It was Entain. And then they turned it down and then the share price collapsed like 80%. Now, I'm not saying it's going to happen again, but you know, you kind of, would you swap equity in a business that you've built up that you know is, as far as you're concerned, as solid as anything, equity in something that a lot of value is based on some EBITDA target in a slowing US market, you know, 3 years from now? So they'd have to raise more cash, I think. So I think that'd be very difficult. You know, Superbet one, it feels weird talking about this, given when I was in banking, we weren't allowed to suggest anything in case, it, you know, compliance and all that.
Oh, the gloves are off now.
Can they do Superbet? Well, who owns Superbet? Is it Blackstone?
Blackstone have an equity stake.
And didn't they say they're spending €1 billion in marketing this year, 200 million of which is in Brazil, to like really kind of push, or something like that, to kind of really push the expansion? So they're going to want to get a hell of a good return. The valuation on that isn't going to be cheap. I mean, trying to buy Kite, because all women have a stake down there in it. And so, you know, given how they're growing, again, all your $3 billion of revenue, are they... And growing. I just don't really see, unless people are willing to accept DraftKings, I don't really see how they're going to be able to afford something of that size, personally. But there's a lot of people paid a lot of money on Wall Street to come up with clever ways to raise money for it to happen. Speaking of which, we haven't really heard about SPACs for a while, have we?
No, the special purpose acquisition company, for anyone who's forgotten, that whole era came and went very quickly. It was very much, it felt very much a pandemic baby. You had DraftKings at the end of 2019 with a, was it Diamond Eagle? Someone like that?
Yes, the Diamond Eagle was one.
Yeah, and well, you had that era, but thinking back, the returns weren't really that great. There was a few companies that listed through that I think have done reasonably well. I think Rush Street Interactive is, you know, a kind of criminally underrated business. I think they've done an incredible job. But looking at the other companies, it moved very quickly from these deals popping up to the SPACs being formed and then doing nothing, you know, essentially missing out in the window to set, you know, to agree the reversed acquisition, and things really have tailed off. There was a point, the Banijay deal, the big TV broadcaster, which obviously includes BitClick Everest Group, when that came to Europe, there was of course speculation about further deals of that type, but we haven't seen that either. I mean, I think that SPAC boom feels well and truly over.
On which, actually, a couple of things I put onto. So I agree. I think Rush Street is something that's doing, I won't call it undervalued, so I'm not going to go into equity valuation, but in terms of what they're doing, and again, talking about investing in the US, their focus on Latin America, you know, I think that they're doing very well. And this segues into, it's almost as if we actually did rehearse this, segues into a lot of stuff we're doing on Latin America. And we've actually got survey data through now for Mexico, Peru, Chile, Argentina, Paraguay, and Colombia, on top of the Brazil stuff, which we'll be launching the next 2 or 3 weeks. Part of that's unprompted brand awareness, and you kind of look at how Rush Street are doing there, Rush Bet in Colombia, in Mexico. I think it's slowed down a little from Mexico, but some of the growth they were seeing, like 90% sequential growth, 60% sequential growth, you know, it's a brand that seems to resonate. And, you know, I think they're primed to do well in Latin America. And at a time when you've got, you know, DraftKings and FanDuel, you know, maybe looking there at some point, I think Rush Street, especially in terms of what Latin America can be for them as a proportion of their earnings compared to the US, you know, DraftKings isn't going to go into Mexico and suddenly become a material part of their business. For Rush Street, Latin America, arguably already is a material part of this, but it's, you know, can be a lot more. So I think that's an area of huge focus. Obviously, it's an area of focus for Padano. It's an area of focus for Superbet to a certain extent. Bit main still the moment, it's an area of focus, Bet365. Betson have just come out and they've been in there for a long time, but now they're really saying, you know, this is an area. And Rush Street are, I think, well positioned there. So yeah, I think that's good. As part of that, actually talking about COVID babies, you know, esports and esports betting, that was the big thing. We put data set together, it was always overestimated how much it is. I've seen a lot of companies fail, Entain, one of their great ideas that they didn't work on it. But actually we've been looking at LATAM and esports, and there's some interesting data that's going to come out of that around, you know, people betting on esports, what they bet on, why they don't bet it. You know, 57% of people who like esports don't bet on it, so they just don't know enough about it for betting. Only 20% said they don't trust the outcomes because of integrity, so there's still the concern about match fixing. And then a lot of esports is actually what you wouldn't necessarily class as esports, like CSGO data, but actually FIFA or NBA 2K, which is, FIFA is often on a football tab, and it's kind of being used instead of, or as an alternative to virtuals. You know, there's no live football soccer games on and do that. So I think, especially in LATAM, that's growing, and that's quite an interesting trend to kind of track, which we'll be doing. I don't know if there's anything else you asked, I completely
God, it was another long question, but that's quite a nice moment to move on, because we are racing through time. We're over 20 minutes already. And let's talk about the US, specifically Nevada, more in the next episode, because we've talked a lot about that already today in a slightly different context. But on Latin America, and I hate to bring it up again because we always bring it up, but the illegal market. So coming out of Peru this week, the Mincitur, the Ministry for Tourism, which is also takes responsibility for gambling regulation, they claim to have cut illegal sites by, I think it was 40% since regulatory framework came in. I'm keen to get your thoughts on that, because Peru is an interesting one in that the path to regulation felt much more efficient, much less torturous than it did in Brazil. It has an established local market, it has international competitors such as Betsson, which you mentioned earlier, and also in outstanding local brands like Apuesta Total, which I think is now majority controlled by Sirsa. So from the numbers, I mean, are you seeing, does that 40% figure sound in any way accurate in terms of cutting that offshore market share?
I suppose the question is, what do they mean by that? Is it someone who didn't have a license before, who's now, you know, got a license? If you look at Apuesta Total, okay, obviously you've not operated there for a long time, you know, got land-based shops, market leader. Is it that they're now under a license regime and therefore that comes from offshore to onshore? Well, you could probably say, yeah. If they're just talking about the number of, because they talked about how many sites they've closed as well. If they're saying they've cut the offshore market by 40% purely, and not because of people now being regulated, but purely because of how many sites they've blocked, then we're going to the age-old thing where a regulator thinks that blocking a website is going to stop people using that exact domain name. And there's no other way to get there, and affiliate traffic doesn't stick it to a link with a XY3 at the end. Or so in that case, no, that number does not sound remotely plausible. As part of this LATAM thing, we are kind of redoing all our illegal market numbers and putting in monthly data for legal and illegal estimates. Don't quite have that answer yet, but hopefully in a couple more episodes time or a couple more months, we'll kind of have that and I'm tracking more accurately. And also just trying to get a handle on the legal market data, because they do include the tax revenues now. So surprisingly, they didn't have, even though land-based bookmaking has been around for however many years there was no tax data on it. There was no actual data on the official size of the market. So now we've kind of got that included. It was just on the slots. But the tax data for this has been included at a higher level with the slots. So there's no actual split out. There is stuff coming out of the market where they talk about how much has been taken from the sports betting tax, so we can kind of make estimates, but I haven't seen any proper official data saying this is the actual split. This is just kind of a minister coming out and kind of giving a quote. So we are starting to see some actual data, and it will be interesting to see how that develops. I mean, it's quite interesting. On our survey, if you look at Peru, we've got an average weekly spend per user of $30, which is almost identical to Chile, Paraguay, Colombia. Argentina's lower, but I mean, to be honest, with the hyperinflation in Argentina and the devaluation of the currency, then it's probably anything in US dollars is a bit difficult. Brazil's a bit higher. So it is really around these other markets that's a similar propensity to more or less average spend. And yeah, I think it'd be a good market. It's obviously smaller just because of population, etc. So you do need more of a share. You can't, you know, Brazil, you can probably make a very good living on 0.5% market share. You can't do that in Peru. But I think Latin America is interesting, you know, it's an exciting time for things now that people have talked about it for a long time, didn't really happen, and now it's starting to happen in these different countries. But the illegal market is still a huge issue, and it will be maybe less so in Peru, just given, you know, it's probably not one that's targeted as much given its size, and you know, a few big ones, but you know, the likes of Argentina with its provincial regulation, Mexico to a slightly lesser extent, and all these other markets, I think it's, there's a lot of work that needs to be done, as you've seen in Brazil, and blocking some websites is not going to cut it.
No. That feels like a good point to end on, because we are well over 20 minutes, so there's going to need to be a few edits made. Hopefully when you're watching this, it is around or just under 20 minutes. But just a little shameless plug for next week. It is going to be at SBC Americas in Miami. So if you see him wandering around looking confused, staring at a floor map, or standing outside looking harassed, go over and say hello. And I will unfortunately not be there. I'm going to Paris I'm actually traveling not for work, so that's very exciting. So we will be back probably in around 2 weeks' time. We are hoping that we can maybe have Ed and Kyle Goldsmith from my team sub in on a special on the ground episode for some impressions of what's going on at the conference next week. But everyone, as ever, thank you so much for listening. This has been another episode of Right to the Source with Robin Harrison and Ed Birkin. See you next time.